Well, hello there, and welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 105, Interview with Megan Ekman. Megan is a fine artist and entrepreneur at Studio Me, where she sells approachable embroidery kits for modern stitchers. In this episode of Getting Work to Work, Megan and I talk about balancing art and entrepreneurship, the role of pattern and imagination, sources of curiosity, and the subjects she continually returns to in her work. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/105. Getting Work to Work is brought to you by Chris Martin Studios, a video production company telling stories with heart, edge, and fearlessness for those who dare to build a better world. Stay in touch with Chris Martin Studios by signing up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive my two latest guides, DIY Documentary and Build Your Platform, as well as weekly inspiration and ways that you can increase your curiosity and wonder. All right, you ready for this interview with Megan? Cue the transitional music. Megan, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. So I'm Megan Ekman. I am the owner and head designer of Studio Me, which creates approachable embroidery kits for modern stitchers. And I am also now really beginning to ramp up my fine art career at the same time as a painter.
Very cool. So let's start with Studio Me. What's the story behind approachable embroidery for modern stitchers?
So when I went to college and got degrees in creative writing and drawing, my mother's requirement was that I had to start a business before I graduated. Hmm. So I did. 2009, Studio Me started. And it sold prints of my fine art. And this ran for about 3 to 4 years. And I moved across country to San Jose, Silicon Valley, so my now husband could get his master's degree. And it got hard. the rent there is insane. And I needed to take a second job in retail, and that I stopped dreaming. It really just killed my creativity. I would come home from work. It was just part-time, and I couldn't do anything. And so when that company declared bankruptcy, I knew right away I didn't want to work for anybody else again. So I started pushing my artwork more and more and more to try and make it fill that kind of gap of finances that I needed. Mm-hmm. And I burned myself out fast and hard. And I started to make art that wasn't what I wanted, but art that I thought would sell. Mm. And looking back, it was a terrible thing to do. And it's actually very hard to sell art prints to wholesale shops, which is what I was trying to do a lot of, as well as fairs. Just the logistics for a shop, it's hard to sell artwork. Mm-hmm. And so one night, completely burned out, I'd probably also been crying, I decided to do something completely different. And I pulled out some fabric, goodness knows what it was from because I'm not crafty, and some black thread, and I turned one of my illustrations that I just inked up into an embroidery design. And I hadn't done embroidery since I was 9. And I have no idea what I wanted to do it that night. It just felt like it had to be something completely different than what I've been doing just to give myself a break for tonight. And I shared it on Facebook. And the next day, I had all these people asking me, how can I do it? I want to make one of these. Do you have a way for me to do it? And then I had the idea, you know, I've always approached things from a very practical point of view, and I wasn't a crafter. So I just went at it from the logistics of like, okay, how could I make this? Let's just try it. And for about 2 years, I sold my fine art and the embroidery together at fairs. Don't do that. Don't ever. It's so confusing to people. And then the embroidery would sell out, the kits that I'd made, and they were so bad to start. But they would sell out, and the artwork wouldn't sell at all. And I knew at that point, you know, just dive in. Just go all out, see what happens. If you fail, oh well, we'll try something else. So I changed the business over 2015 to just embroidery kits. And it really just went from there. I mean, it just got easy in a way to sell. Shops suddenly understood what I was selling, and it was much easier for social media purposes to just have one thing. And what I realized is that so many people want something to do after work that is tactile, that isn't a computer screen, that they can feel productive while binging on Netflix and drinking. Or some people use it for meditation. It's kind of like a moving meditation, or adult coloring books. I have lots of people give them as gifts for people recovering from surgeries or in hospitals. Or the embroidery kits give you the ability to have time with yourself.
Yeah.
And just to kind of slow down. Mm-hmm. And it seems to, you know, now is the time when that is needed more than before, perhaps. And so we're seeing a big resurgence for, you know, macrame and embroidery and just kind of these, what some people think of as old, but we're definitely modernizing them. I see myself as an outsider because I am not crafty at all. I had a series on my blog once that was Crafting with Megan, and it was like, and then you don't have that fabric, so you cut up your cat's sweater because that's all you've got to work with, you know. So I make it as approachable as possible because so many people are new to this, and it's intimidating because you see the stuff that maybe your grandma did, and it's so fine and so persnickety, and I just kind of like tell them this is hand-holding. You know, it's color-coded, it's super easy, we've got videos, you know, it's really letting a new generation try something without fear.
Yeah. I'm completely intrigued by something that you said at the start of that, was your mom encouraged you to make a business before you graduated from art school, which is, that, let's just say that's not normal for most art school experiences.
No.
I mean,
she was a business major.
Okay.
She wanted to make sure that I could, I think she always knew I could succeed at whatever I did, but I think it was, she really wanted me to feel like I knew what I was going to do as soon as I got out. Mm-hmm. Because we took a tour of the school I eventually went to, and I asked, because I'd asked at all the schools I went to, what percentage of your students go on to have a career as a fine artist? And some of the schools would say, our students have an appreciation for art when they graduate, which equals zero. Or like, they all become teachers. And I was like, well, that's great, but
right.
I knew that wasn't my personality type. And so this one said 10%. And I think that scared her. And I saw that more of as, fine, I'll just be one of the 10%. Like, at least you have a percentage.
Hmm. Interesting. Did you wrestle with that at first? I mean, it was like, I don't want to start a business. I just want to do my art. Or was it more of just like, yeah, I see where you're coming from, Mom?
I didn't intend to go into art. My parents knew early on, my father was kind of an artist. He didn't have the chances to do much with his abilities. So they could tell early on that I had inherited some of that from him. Mm-hmm. So they put me in everything that they could. And everybody basically just said, always growing up, you know, this is what you're good at. This is amazing. You need to keep doing this. And so going into college, I knew that I wanted to take as many classes as I could, but I actually didn't intend to major in it. But the only way you could take the classes was to major. So I just decided, okay, I guess I'll double major. I always knew that I wanted to work for myself and be independent. I had intended to be a writer, which is something I am still working on now. And so I kind of figured, I knew I needed to make money. And so starting a business, I had followed enough people kind of online who were a few years older than me who were selling their work. And so I knew it was just the next step. You know, it was just what I had to do. If I was going to sell my work, I needed a business structure.
Wow. That's a really cool story because it's full of, I think, practical, actionable advice for people because
I'm from the Midwest. We are just practical people.
Something that you wrote on your site that I kind of latched onto was that you believe in the beauty of simplicity. What do you mean by that?
So that is definitely for the embroidery side. Mm-hmm. In my art side, I'm like as detailed as you can get. But for embroidery, I really like the... okay, so I'll just tell you the secret. Yeah. I really can't embroider. my grandma stopped my lessons. You know, like we used to do pillowcases together. Mm-hmm. And these awesome zip-up hoodies with cats on the back.
Ooh.
I know. So cool until you're 13. But we got to French knots, which some people adore and are supposed to be so easy. And I could not figure it out. And at that point, we just kind of stopped. You know, like, she got tired of taking out my knots, and I got tired of trying it. So I can't do most of the really gorgeous stitches that are all the rage today. And so I realized that if I'm going to get somebody new into this, it needs to be as approachable and easy as possible. And given my sort of pen and ink art background, I knew the power of just simple straight lines. And instead of making somebody fill in an area with solid stitches that all perfectly line up and, or, you know, making French knots to give something texture, I could come up with a different pattern that was non-traditional, that was honestly just up and down. And that really helps shape all of the designs that I do make. So I made new floral designs this year, which was something I never thought I'd tackle because florals are so traditional and so persnickety. And so it was kind of like, how do I make it? Mm-hmm. Instead of what, like looking at what everybody else is doing and knowing there's no way my customer could do that as their first one because I don't even know what that person's doing. And so, you know, just kind of like, what is the simplest form that this could take, but still, when you step back, really have an impact.
Hmm. So how does that philosophy of simplicity impact other areas of your life? I would imagine it trickles down.
Yeah. So in my fine art, like I said, I'm kind of the opposite, but in my life, I am a borderline minimalist. I have, you know, like, it's like the capsule wardrobe, which is, you know, it's like 10 shirts, you know, all in one color range, everything. Honestly, like I don't let anything into the house without getting rid of something else. It comes from having to move a few times early on, and it's just always wanting to be able to fit back into that certain crate. So I really like to just have everything so that I don't have to think about it. So, you know, like the wardrobe, it's all the same. It just, you know, it's like Obama with his suits. It's just like, you just put it on or, I have a routine every day that I do, and some people would think that's just insane, but it just makes it so that I don't have to think about things, and that allows me to move through the day faster, but also, you know, just feel secure and also be able to kind of daydream because it's not trying to figure out what to do next. Yeah. You just already know.
So if you wouldn't mind sharing, what is your routine? What does your day look like?
Sure. My cat gets me up before I was like. First wake up is 5:30. Second wake up is 6. So at about 6, I get up. I feed the cat. And then I actually, so I work out. So in the summer or when it's not raining, I'm on my bicycle. Otherwise, I'm just downstairs. Mm-hmm. And then after breakfast, from about 10 to noon, I just work on the fine art because I need to get it done just first thing in the day. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's too easy to push aside. And so I always leave it so that I know what I'm going to do the next day. And that way it's easy to start. It's not being daunted by, I want to start a new project, but I don't even know what that's going to be because that takes hours.
Yeah.
So then my husband works for me. So we have our big meal of the day at noon. And we are foodies, so that takes a while. So at about 2, I sit down and then I work until 5 on Studio Me. Mm-hmm. So depending on the day of the week, that's doing admin stuff, answering emails, filling orders, ordering supplies. Some days it's pitching magazines, podcasts, blogs. And then a lot of times there's like breaks in there. So walks. I live by the historic Fort Vancouver here. Mm-hmm. And so we just walk around that to get out of the house. And then at about 7 to 7:30, we shut everything down for the day and have supper. And just we either just talk or have board games or, you know, go out, do something. But it sounds like I don't work, you know, it's like 4 to 5 hours a day. But I've gotten really good at focusing on what needs to be done each day and not having distractions. And so that's actually, you know, the equivalent of what most people work in an 8-hour day. I just plug it into 4 to 5 instead.
Right. That's excellent. I love the insight into your routine because it gives a glimpse into the next question that I have is, as an artist and an entrepreneur, how do you maintain balance between both worlds?
I always think balance is an illusion. you can't have it. So almost every day, there's the 2 hours for the fine art from 10 to noon. And Sunday is my off day. Mm-hmm. So that is more art. Although honestly, sometimes I really just lay in bed for 2 hours doing crossword puzzles. But there are some times where, you know, the schedule needs to be changed because, like, I had to go get work scanned recently so we can make prints from it. So that took a while. Or the business intrudes. The other day I had to run to the post office at 9 in the morning because we had to get something out for a magazine. You know, they're always 3 months ahead, but like 2 hours ahead, really. So they're just like, we need this now. So reality does intrude. For me, I kind of always have, every day, it's like one big thing for each side needs to get done. Mm. So for art, sometimes that is just the 2 hours. Other times it's, you know, I have to pitch X number of galleries as well. Or we need to get that copyright finally finished up. And then for the business, it's, you know, this needs to get done. So I kind of like to keep everything, every day, moving. Mm-hmm. It's just easier. If I start to stop, then it can just keep, it can stay stuck for an embarrassing amount of time, and I just keep getting grumpier and grumpier every day that I'm not getting the art done. Mm-hmm. Not so much the business, I don't get grumpy about that. The art, if I don't get that time, I just get really, whatever, like, the physical version of, like, the art version of hangry is.
That's interesting. What would the art version of hangry be?
I know, because
like, your pen.
People can tell. I mean,
your pen eats you. In your fine art side, there was a statement on your website that was really interesting to me, and it said that you revel in the aesthetic interplay of pattern and imagination. What does that mean?
Yeah, okay, so you asked me this, and I turned to my husband, and I read it out, and I go, did I write that? And he goes, no, I put it on there. I thought it sounded good. And I was like, you gotta tell me when you do these things. he got his master's in art, so he's always like pulling stuff out of his, like, I'll be honest, a BA in art really equals a BS degree. I mean, you just learn to BS anything. So I had him explain what his idea was, and it ended up being exactly what I assumed it was. I just loved it. I was like, you didn't even tell me you put that on there.
That's awesome.
I have always been drawn to narrative artwork and pattern. So I love arts and crafts wallpaper. I have no idea why. I've always been a fan of the Pre-Raphaelites and then the arts and crafts and just that intricacy and the over-the-top detail just blows my mind. And I really like narrative work that doesn't tell the whole story, so that there are several different versions that, depending on how imaginative you are, you could come up with. And so the most recent series of mine, called Flatteringly Flat, is portraits of the backsides of people. And so you just have the head and shoulders, and then this elaborate wallpaper, both behind them and also in the clothing. So you have this kind of tension between the patterns, and then the pattern that the person themselves creates with the repetition of elaborate hairdos. So what that one is it's the narrative that the viewer gets to create in terms of who are these people, but also, you know, when you stand in line behind somebody and you see their head and you, without knowing it, it's kind of like the Gestalt theory, you make a face for them just by the assumptions of what they're wearing. You can probably know what color their eyebrows are. You could guess the eye color. You can see if there's glasses. And then when they turn, it's always a surprise. You can never quite get it right. And that was kind of this idea that went into it, that we always see portraits from the front. And what if you made the viewer work more? And you will just automatically imagine what that person looks like without me even telling you to do it. I really was drawn to that kind of idea of how could I make you work even more?
That's cool. I'm, as you're talking and describing it, I'm looking at the cover of the Open Studios tour guide.
Yeah.
And it has one of your drawings on there. And I'm just like, wow, that's really cool. Hearing you talk about it and then looking at the work at the same time. So with that, you are opening your studio as part of Clark County's Open Studios tour. And so what do you hope people discover when they visit your studio?
Oh my gosh, I am so nervous. Because it's our apartment.
I'd be nervous too.
Yeah, I had to check with them that was allowed. So we were informed to clean up, but not really clean up. And so I am, honestly, every day I'm looking at my desk, towing the line of how messy do I want it to be? Because at the moment it's an explosion. There's gold leaf dust everywhere. It's even in the cat.
Is your cat's name Gold Leaf?
It will be soon. She's rolled in enough of it. What I'm hoping people begin to see is that not all artists have these gorgeous dream studios. I have a whole Pinterest board of dream studios, and mine is honestly the living room. I will move the two chairs out of the way that we sit in for dinner, but that's about it. Our apartment does not, because it's two artists living in it and running a business, it doesn't look like an apartment you would live in. It honestly looks more like a studio. But I kind of hope people see that we just make do. You know, like, we make do with the space that we have. We turn it into an inspirational place as best we can. But if they themselves are thinking of, you know, being artists, you don't need a nice concrete floor, giant glass, you know, giant windows everywhere. You know, you can find inspiration in the small spaces. You can convert. You can cover your carpet with drop cloths. You know, you can just kind of make do, and it can still be an inspiring place.
It seems, as you're talking and describing that too, that it goes back to why you started Studio Me, and that was to make art accessible.
Yeah, I really, so when I started, you're absolutely correct. When I started the business, I wanted to give people creativity, basically. I wanted them to fill their home with things that made them laugh and things that made them think and things that made them imagine. And when I couldn't do it as well as I'd hoped initially with the art prints, I realized that the embroidery let them be the artist. And that then helped me make peace with the fact that I was selling not my fine art, but a different type of art. Mm-hmm. I still always want people to know that everybody is creative. Mm-hmm. We're simply told to stop. Mm-hmm. Everybody has an imagination. Some just give it more free rein than others. It comes down to spending time on something to get better at it. Because anybody can learn to draw, really. You can. I still haven't gotten my mother to try it all. but I know if she did put in any bit of time, she'd get better. Mm-hmm. But I really am hoping one day that we can push through the last obstacle, which is, I honestly think drawing is the hardest one for people to assume that they can do. Because now, to my husband's disappointment, in some ways, everybody thinks they're a photographer, which makes it harder for photographers.
Yes.
A lot of people, you know, would assume that they could, you know, maybe play with clay. But as soon as you tell somebody to draw, it's an instant shutdown. And I haven't quite ever figured out why. You know, they'll paint abstract for you, but have them draw anything and they won't even pick up the pencil.
I'm intrigued. I'm trying to think why, because I know for myself, drawing is very personal. And to some degree, it's like there's a level of, I think, perfection and realism that is the level of standard.
Yeah. And it just instantly terrifies you.
Yeah. So do you have a subject that you continually return to in your work, in your fine art?
I do. So when I was little, my dad was a portrait drawer, not for money or anything. He was just always drawing women's faces and men's faces and just, you know, the human body. We had all the, you know, like the naughty books in our house, you know, art books, nudes that I would unknowingly take to school. It was just normal. And when I got to be a teenager, I told him, I don't want to be like you. I'm going to draw the opposite. And so I drew animals for like 5 years. And then I got into college and we started working from casts. And then you get to go up to live models after the first year and they know that you're in drawing class, not just taking the 101s. And as soon as I drew my first portrait from a live model, I stepped back. And I went, oh, darn it. I turned into my father. Because, I mean, he could have drawn it. It was just there. It was exactly the same. And it was, in some ways, you know, it just made me feel good. Like, oh, well.
Yeah.
And so from then on, it's just the human figure has really intrigued me. I just think there's so much beauty in the diversity and just the amount of poses and also, you know, just like what you can put on and your figures and what stories you can tell. I think it's really endless.
So you mentioned earlier as well that you were working a job, you were getting burnt out and you stopped dreaming. What do you dream about? Like what are you curious about?
My night dreams or just like
just daydreams?
Daydreams. Like, okay. Yeah. So like night dreams. You don't want
to
go.
We don't need to go into the subconscious.
I have an overactive imagination. I am one of those people that is curious about everything to the point that I drive the people close to me nuts because I hear any story on the radio and I ask them questions and I know they can't answer the question. I just want to ask the question. So I listen to podcasts like No Such Thing as a Fish, which is from a British team that runs QI, the quite interesting game show. And it's just facts that they find every week that they think are interesting. Mm. And it blows my mind every week. And it's so interesting. I love learning about the free market economy. I enjoy global politics. I enjoy science, like how to make paint like we used to. It honestly is everything. I think the world is truly, truly magical. And there are so many amazing things out there if you actually just look. When I go on hikes with my husband, I'm generally like 20 feet behind and completely in a daze because I'm just looking at everything. And I'm always finding like there are little caterpillars here, and I call them mustaches because they're all black and furry. They kind of look like gummy worms. But it's like I'm always finding the mustaches. And like, in terms of what am I always dreaming about, for me, if it isn't a narrative for a new piece, it is what I want out of life. Like, what is the pie in the sky art exhibit? Don't get specific. It doesn't matter where it is or that it's not logical. Like, how do I want people to interact with the work? Or if money's no object, what is the way that I think this would just knock your socks off to display it? So I'll give you the example for the Flatteringly Flat with all the wallpaper. I know a company that will print my designs on the wallpaper that's removable. And pie in the sky exhibit is you actually have strips of wallpaper behind each frame that matches the picture.
Cool.
And so you walk down, you know, the gallery and it's just all wallpapered. Like, that's pie in the sky, money's no object. Doesn't matter that it's $100 to go from ceiling to floor with the wallpaper. And so that kind of keeps me going. It's just, what's the coolest thing I could think of for the art? And let's start taking some steps to go in that direction and see what happens.
I love that description too, because I think sometimes when art is just one goal after another, it kind of gets exhausting and it gets, I don't know, I think sometimes we lose touch with what art is actually meant to do, that it's not just about goal to goal to goal. I don't know, when the way you're describing that pie in the sky makes it fun again to a certain degree.
Yeah, I mean, I have a dream for one which makes no sense, and that is to have it look like an office room with one of those awful break tables and work chairs, and there's just a shelf, one of those nasty faux wood ones, and it's just full of boxes that I've made. And when you open the box, there's like a new world inside. So like it's all these papers that I've created for you to read through and sort out a murder mystery, or letters between two people, you know, that I've made all the postcards, faked all the stamps and everything. You know, it's just, it makes no sense, but it really, it's like something inside of me just kind of starts to go, oh my, you know, like jumping up and down like a little kid. And you kind of just have to go with that feeling and go, you know what, let's just make one of those boxes. And it makes, you know, you have no idea where it's going to go. I was into taxidermy for about a month in January. My husband is so nice. He just like rolls with the punches as I'm getting book after book on how to taxidermy dead animals. I really think you just need to investigate everything that makes you excited, even if you have no idea what you're going to do with it. Yeah. And even if it comes to nothing, I mean, I decided not to attempt to, you know, stuff a mouse. But I've got some cool ideas for other artwork because of it, because I now know how they stuff mice and weird things like that.
Yeah. How do they stuff mice?
So the books that I read, I wasn't able to get the modern ones. I got the 18th century ones, and it just kept saying, like, do not do this at all, because it's all these, like, arsenic chemicals. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, they basically skinned it and articulated it with wire, and then they would just stuff it with straw. But you did have to, they would kind of, like, cover them with bell jars halfway through to let the hides kind of begin to cure themselves, but not let in any bugs. So, but yeah, it's mostly dangerous back then.
Yeah.
They just kept saying, like, do not buy this. Do not do this.
Well, it's interesting, though, to, like, read about how things were done in the past, because I think in our modern society, we're so disconnected from, I think, a lot of things that were once commonplace.
Yeah, and what's really interesting for people who paint is to know how paints are made. So we had demonstrations in my art school for making printmaking ink, mm-hmm. and it took the whole class period to make like a teaspoon of ink. Mm. But you really have more of appreciation for certain colors, so that when you go to the store and you get that lapis lazuli blue, that's like $40 for a tiny little tube, you understand why it's so, you know, you've got crushed up precious minerals in there. Mm-hmm. And I think you can appreciate some things a lot more, or even just the Pre-Raphaelites were very knowledgeable of the symbolism of flowers. Mm-hmm. So there's so many hidden messages in all of their paintings for what each flower means. And they were aware of that. They knew what all the colors meant, the flowers, even some of like the tapestry designs that they chose would have been historical references that their audience would get. And that's something that we don't play on as much now.
Yeah. So originally my question for you was going to be, what is one book or resource every creative professional should read? And I think I want to amend that to, what is one book on your shelf right now that you are intrigued by and can't put down?
So I am just finishing up You Are a Badass at Making Money.
Nice. I've read that.
By Jen Sincero. It's amazing.
It's a very good book.
It's very good. It's basically figuring out what your internal relationship is with money. Mm-hmm. And addressing that to move forward. Yeah. And the universe wants you to be the best that you can be. And when you take steps toward it, it will start to throw things at you that, one, can, you know, cause some anxiety, but two, will also move you forward. Mm-hmm. And it has happened enough times in my life that I am really beginning to believe it. And I knew with my business and my art, but in order to get to the next step, because I kind of had plateaued for about a year with Studio Me, and I just couldn't figure out what the holdup was. And I realized it was mostly me. It's just childhood things or, you know, early adult things that you just bury, that you didn't know was holding you up. A lot of people have issues with being getting rich. Mm-hmm. I had no issue with being rich. It's like, bring it on, I don't care. You know, it's like, you'll be worried, you'll go bad. I'm like, nope, don't care, won't go bad. I know that's fine. Or your family won't like you. Like, my parents just retired in Hawaii. That's not an issue. People still love them. And so it really, I've only had the book, it's due back at the library now, 3 weeks. And since starting to read it, my sales in my business have doubled, if not tripled, over the past 3 weeks. I know. And I have somebody who's meeting with me to see if they can't put the flatteringly flat prints in a new hair salon barbershop that's opening in the city. You know, it's just taking, it was taking some steps that I was scared to do. Mm-hmm. Before the call we were discussing today, I called up and got my virtual assistant working for me now. You know, it was shelling out money, which will get me more money, you know. But the book is really, really good, because so many people just hold themselves back, and I think artists, especially when it comes to charging what you're worth, mm-hmm. and this goes for business too, but I know when my husband and I are in the preview show for Open Studios, we might get some people looking at our prices going, are you serious? But we know what we're worth. Mm-hmm. And we know the people that we want to go after. And I would rather not sell the work than sell the work at a price that I feel wasn't worth my time.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it does, because I think there's a recurring theme in a lot of the interviews I've had with people, and a recurring theme in my own business, where you undersell so that you at least have something coming in, and then yep. you immediately resent
that person.
That person, yourself, and it's just, yeah, it becomes hell on earth at that point for everyone yeah. involved.
Yeah. I was in an agreement, I was unofficially in a licensing contract. Neither of us realized it was a licensing contract for 4 years. And I just, I went to an art conference and I was showing somebody my project, and they asked how much I got paid, and I told them. And she like slapped me in the face and was like, how could you? She's like, you are worth, so add zeros to that. And I was like, okay. And I went back and I realized, yeah, I really started to hate working with this individual on the contract, because it wasn't even her fault. It was mine. I was just so mad that I was getting so little, and I could have done so much more with the project if I just charged what I felt I was worth at the time. Mm-hmm. Instead of, like you said, just making it so that you feel like you have something in the bank.
Yeah.
You just continue to get more like that, unfortunately, if that's what you do.
Yeah.
Because it's much harder to get people to pay you if you suddenly double your prices.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to just start as high as you want and get the right people from the get-go.
That's right. Well, final question for you, Megan. I've honestly enjoyed this interview so much. And the question that I have for you is, at any point, have you struggled with the routine and the schedule that you have? Or did you ever have this pull to adopt a traditional 9-to-5 mentality?
My husband and I have this discussion about 3 times a year. So most creative people, you cycle mm-hmm. Between being very creative and getting diddly, piddly done. And everybody has a different length of cycle. And mine, I kind of like ride a high and then I get to a depressive low, and I get like 3 to 4 a year. And those weeks, and it lasts like 2 weeks, I honestly think to myself, I really just wish I had a 9-to-5. Only because the appeal of ending at 5 and going home with nothing. But I'm the sort that I have too many hobbies, so that would be an issue. It would still be an issue. I'd have too much to do. And then there'd be, like, the chores. Like, the chores never go away. I mean, most people spend their weekend just, like, cleaning their house and stuff. So I'm hoping on this next down, which is probably coming in a month, that by then I'm in a little bit better place, because I've started to hire people. Mm-hmm. And I have also convinced my husband that I should be able to hire a cleaning lady who comes once a month.
Yes.
Because ain't nobody got time for this.
No, it's brilliant.
No, and it's not like my house is that dirty. I don't want to do it. I would rather help somebody else out. And that's the mindset you have to get into, is I'm giving the money. It's not like I'm above them. I'm helping them. They get an extra however much it costs to clean my bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Same with the VA. It's extra money for this lady working part-time. She gets to pay off student debt. She gets to do... I'm an enabler. I'm helping yeah. other people. So I think the urge for the 9-to-5 will begin to fade. Because my husband always points out, we couldn't go ride in our bikes whenever we want. We couldn't just pop in the car at 3 when we go, ooh, Dairy Queen sounds really good. Like, you can just pop off. It happens more frequently than it should. We couldn't do things like that. And that's what it always comes back to, is, there's so much that you do. And now that I'm finally getting help, I can really alleviate some of the workload. So in your first 2 years, you will honestly just work from like 10 to 11, 10 a.m. to 11 p.m., you know, and you won't know if it's worth it. But there are these small moments that you begin to realize, you know, other people, even if they have a 9-to-5, they take work home or they have to commute. I don't have to commute.
Yeah.
You don't know how much time you have. You might as well spend it doing what you like to make sure that, you know, if you die tomorrow, you were at least so close, you know. That kind of keeps me going. It's like, well, you know, what if I don't get that work of, you know, that collection made? Mm-hmm. If I die before it is, that's not gonna be great. I don't have enough legacy left, you know, to mark me when I go. And on that depressing note,
yeah. No, that's a nice sobering note to end on, because I think there is that, I think there's a long-term focus that we need to have with our work to make sure that we are producing work and thinking about a body of work and not just these one-off approaches to life, essentially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. This has been a fun conversation, and I wish you all the success in the world today, tomorrow, and in the coming months.
Aw, thank you. You too.
Yeah. And I will talk with you again hopefully soon. That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this podcast. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. You can drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.